Hello there, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to Series 2 of my podcast, I Never Thought It Would Happen. A podcast made in collaboration with my great friends, the amazing charity Help Musicians. And welcome also to a young band from Stockport, who are now part of the lineage of amazing bands who've come out of the Greater Manchester area. They recently put out their fourth album, Ribbon Around the Bomb, and AllMusic originally described them as a cross between The Doors and the Arctic Monkeys. But they've now become so much more than that. So please welcome Tom, Joe and Charlie from Blossoms. Hey Blossoms, I'm Chris Difford and this is my podcast for Help Musicians. I never thought it would happen. How are you today?
Very well, mate. Well, yeah.
Thank you, yeah.
Good. Thanks for having us on.
Oh, it's brilliant to see you. Huge fan. And what's this room that you're in? Explain it.
It's our rehearsal room.
Here come the tea.
Yeah, we've rehearsed all over a little bit. We started off in Charlie's granddad's scaffolding yard. And we used to have a little unit in there, which we actually took the cover of the first album was in the scaffolding at the back, like in the yard area. So we used to rehearse there. Then we kind of outgrew that place as we got more successful, I suppose. And then we ended up renting a place under like the viaduct in Stockport in a mill. And then we outgrew that place, didn't we? So then Joe kind of suggested we should buy somewhere and invest and instead of renting, which we did. So we bought this big unit. Which was kind of, what was it used for before this?
It was acrylic sign making factory.
Yeah.
Perfect.
And when we moved in, they actually made us an acrylic sign. Blossoms. Which was a nice touch.
Did they? Yeah. How sweet is that? Yeah. That's amazing.
And then we built this room as like a, this is like a purpose-built soundproof room to rehearse in. So there's like a band set up over there with like the cans and stuff and we'll rehearse over there. And this is obviously just like a chilling out area next to it.
And it's got all our storage, room for a studio eventually upstairs one day maybe.
Yeah, it's got a mezzanine above and stuff like that, so it's a great little unit. Well, great unit, not little.
Sounds good, and the most important thing I can see there is two packets of biscuits.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's more, actually. What are we on here, Chaz?
Chris, these are McVitie's VIBs, which stands for Very Important Biscuits. And these are just your bog standard
Maryland. I used to sell
there's
them
some crunch. Get us them crunch ones up there. They're my favourites, then. What are they? These are good. There you go.
Crunch creams.
Fox's Golden Crunch Creams. They're fabulous.
Got a strong selection here.
I used to work with a band called The Stripes, and the drummer would eat a whole packet of biscuits before he went on stage. I was so impressed.
Really?
Before you... I can't eat before I go on stage.
No? Why is that?
I don't know. I think because you're playing drums, it's quite active.
Yeah.
We're all a bit like that. Yeah. Like, when it's like when we finish sound check, as soon as that's done, we go for tea. We don't like eating close to stage time. Sitting on your stomach before you're moving about, and that's not the one, is it?
Yeah. Have you heard of the Help Musicians charity?
Yeah, didn't we do some bits in lockdown with it? Or something like that, maybe. It's been around a while, hasn't it?
They've been around over 100 years, and during the pandemic, they handed out 20 million quid to people that... you know, couldn't support themselves, and I thought that was an amazing thing.
Yeah, it's class. I remember it all at the time. I'm pretty sure we did donate some stuff, but I might be wrong there, but yeah.
All right, So how did you guys sort of get together? Were you at school, or what was the story there?
So me and Joe went to school together, and we're kind of like the oldest friendship in the band.
Yeah.
We met on a school trip to Alton Towers. When we were 12 years old and remained friends since then. And then we ended up in different bands in our kind of mid to late teens, didn't we, really?
We tried a band early days, didn't we? But I was terrible.
Couldn't even play the drums.
No, I was shocking. Yeah, really bad.
Then I started a band after that. And I was in a band with like a friend from school, or a couple of friends from school, really. And Joe used to come as more like a cheerleader, wasn't he? Like, he just used to kind of...
I wanted to try and edge my way in to be some sort of manager at one point.
Yeah.
And then I turned to, like, trying to record you at some point.
Yeah. He was always in and around it, and he'd be at the gigs, and he'd play tambourine and stuff, and then Joe ended up...
I was like a poor man's Bez.
Yeah. But then you ended up being in a band with Charlie. So, Charlie, you've been in bands for probably the same amount of time as I was, you know?
I mean, the first band I was in was a school band, you know, sort of doing all the classics like Knocking on Heaven's Door and all that kind of business. That was in high school. And when I left high school, I was in a few different bands and then ended up meeting Joe through a mutual friend
Yeah. The hotel. I used to work at a hotel in Stockport
called the Alma Lodge.
And I, my supervisor, he was a cool guy to be fair, James Farley. And he was like in a band.
He was a singer in a band. Yeah. He wrote songs and was a singer and stuff.
Yeah, and he said, oh, I've got like this band together and stuff, but I feel like I've got everything, but not got a drummer. So that's where I was like, well, I'm really bad, but I can sort of keep a beat, you know, if you want to just... And I was dead honest. I was like, you know, if you want to just rehearse to Summit, I don't mind having a jam and stuff. So, and that was where he took me down to meet Charlie, who said, oh, yeah, I'll play in the band with you.
And obviously, my granddad had this scaffolding yard with the room built already.
Perfect.
And then we started jamming in there.
Yeah.
That's amazing. But when you guys were 12 years old, the two of you that were close together there, what sort of music were you listening to?
We were both always into music, but we probably... properly became obsessed when we were kind of maybe like 14, and it was like Oasis, wasn't it? We went to watch Oasis at Heaton Park when we were 16, and it was mainly Oasis was what we were obsessed with.
I think that's what made us, because we were mates and things, but I think that's what made us super close mates.
Yeah.
When it came to that sort of time when you're sort of 12 and that, I don't know, I feel like you've not really exactly made your mind up on things at that point. You know what I mean? You're sort of quite manual. You sort of listen to what your mates listen to. You're sort of trying a few different, I mean, I was anyway, trying a few different things out, like, even like my dress sense, you know, things down to the smallest detail. You're like sort of trying things out and trying to find your place in the world, I suppose.
And find like-minded people who you get on with. And then you end up the ones that stick are usually the ones you've got the most in common with, isn't it?
And that's what it was. But I think, do you know what I mean? As soon as I sort of like started actually taking notice to what mum and dad were listening to in the car and things like that, I was like, oh. And then I remember you having a guitar once and playing like trying to play the Smiths.
Yeah, so my mum, you know, my mum and dad were like, my mum's a massive Smiths fan, my dad's a massive music fan from all areas, but like, you know, loved Oasis, loved the Stone Roses and all that. So that was kind of ingrained into me from being a really young kid, really.
Yeah.
So once I started learning guitar, I'd learn all them kind of songs as much as I could, and, you know, Joe would buzz off it, I suppose.
Yeah, no, it was. And then that was what sort of brought us, like, that sort of mates into like a real close sort of best friends.
Yeah.
Brother-in-law.
What was it about Oasis that kind of pulled you in? Was it the fact that they were like a gang of blokes playing in a band?
For me, it was always the songs. Like, I just loved the, you know, the choruses and the melodies, and I just became obsessed. And obviously my mum and dad were into them. My mum went to Main Road and watched them and stuff, so I was shown my earliest memories is probably seeing them on Top of the Pops of music, if that makes sense. So it's been there for a long time. And then when I got to an age where I could kind of understand it, I still loved it and just became obsessed. So, and I think it probably was a bit of the, you know, they were from down the road and they were working class and they made it. And that kind of resonated with us, because literally we're like 7 bus stops away from where they grew up.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great title for a song, 7 bus stops away.
I'm going to put that in my notes.
I love that.
I was going to say, I think mine wasn't really the songs as much, do you know what I mean? Like mine was
the attitude.
Yeah, the attitude and the, like Tom was mentioning, where they were from and being so close to it. The same with Cortinas as well, do you know what I mean? That was a band that sort of followed on, and that was like, oh, they're from around here and they've done something. Because like I say, like Tom mentioned there, I was a massive fan of Tom's band and Tom's writing, and I couldn't exactly play an instrument, so I didn't really take to it. I don't know, I just wanted to do something within music and started loving that whole, you know what I mean, everything about it.
Another point about Oasis, I think, by this point, when we were into them, like, YouTube was a big thing, and you could just watch all the old interviews, and they're just really funny.
Yeah.
Like, they were just like, there's like hours and hours of interviews where you can just watch them, you know, being themselves but being funny. And I think that was part of it as well. They had a lot of personality. They wasn't just, oh, we're in a band and we're mysterious. It was kind of the opposite of that. It was kind of...
I was going to say, do you remember that video? Yeah. It was like, best bits of Liam, part one.
They're also a very difficult band to mimic. You can't kind of nick lyrics from them.
Yeah. No.
Such an individual sound, I guess.
I think so. And obviously, it's weird saying that, because then they wore their influences so firmly on their sleeve from like the Beatles and all that, but they do end up their own thing. But then, yeah, we ended up being a bit unsatisfied in all the bands we were in. So when Charlie and Joe were in a band, their singer was a bit... He just kind of didn't dedicate it as much, did he?
No. It's that classic thing of just like all 5 brains or 4 brains within the band have to be going in the same direction. And if one's sort of just a bit... lacks, it doesn't work, does it? You've all sort of got to be heading in that direction.
Right.
I think that's the hardest thing about being in a band and, in quote unquote, making it, is that every single person's got to be on the same wavelength, they've got to be putting equal amounts into it. You could be the best band in the world, but as soon as one person starts not having that vibe, then it's so hard to get out of that. Like, how do you possibly get out of that? Well, from our experience, anyway, I'm sure other bands might disagree, but from our experience, I think that's one of the biggest things that we've found, is that all five of us, when we got together, just wanted it.
Yeah, we were all at the same place. Or maybe Josh was a little bit younger. He was 15 when he joined, but I suppose he saw how much we kind of done the pub circuit a bit and kind of was like really ready for this, and he just got swept up with the momentum and then was on board as much as we were, you know.
Did you ever do any covers when you first started playing in pubs and clubs?
We did. The first ever gig came about because there was kind of a crossover period, which I kind of felt a little bit bad about. It was a bit like a relationship. It kind of felt like cheating in a way, which was...
You're like a one-man band, aren't you? You're like a...
Loyal, do you mean?
Yeah, like you couldn't do ever being like two bands, and that was it at the time. You're like, you know, and loads of musicians were in like multiple bands, didn't it?
But at that time, I was becoming unsatisfied in that band, and I was writing these kind of different songs. I was in my first relationship. I felt like my songwriting was becoming its own thing. These guys were unhappy in their band, and Joe, obviously, we were best friends, so he was just like, come on, rehearse with me. Rehearse with us, come down. And eventually I said, yeah. So I kind of started doing it on the sly with these and kind of felt a little bit bad about it. But then we'd rehearsed for maybe 2 months, and they were still in their band and I was still in mine. We hadn't broke up at that point. But their band got offered a gig at Night and Day Cafe. And
we knew, I remember me and Charlie being like, this is a great gig to get in. Because obviously Night and Day is one of them venues. And it was like a great slot.
But you didn't get paid, did you?
No, yeah, like you said, there's a classic thing. You don't get paid unless there's like over
X amount of tickets,
30 people you've got to bring. And if you bring over 30 people, you get £1 per head for who you bring.
Oh, no.
So we were like...
Disaster.
Yeah, well, our first band, we were like, well, our lead singer was like, oh, I don't want to do that. And I mean, suppose, fair enough.
He just didn't have the same drive as us, which is fair enough, you know.
I suppose he was seeing it before. He wanted to get some sort of financial gain. It's fair enough, I suppose, but...
And we saw it as a perfect opportunity to...
Yeah, well, it was your idea.
You were like, should we just do it as Blossoms? And I was a bit like, oh, I don't really want to do it. But we already had the name at this point because we used to go past the pub in Stockport called The Blossoms, and I always thought it was a good name for a band, and told Joe.
Mm.
And then Charlie thought the exact same thing and told Joe. So Joe had had it from two different people who didn't really know each other saying the same thing about the band name. So as soon as we got together, it was always going to be Blossoms or The Blossoms. So we had the name, but this is my point about covers. When we got offered that gig, we only had about five songs or four songs. So we threw in two covers, actually. We did Love Me Do by the Beatles. I played harmonica.
It was good.
Which sounded all right.
And I have to have heard that.
Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon.
Yeah.
All right.
So they were the two covers that we did, with maybe three original songs or four original songs or something like that. So, and we do still do covers, you know, over the, you know, if we're doing a big gig and stuff, we'll throw in a cover because, you know, it's always fun.
It's always a surprise. Yeah, it's always nice.
I do what I had as well. We bought 35 people, so got paid £35. And
we got a parking ticket for £35 outside.
Oh, no.
Do you know what? Charlie found the email yesterday.
Found the email the other day. It was, yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Bloody hell, look.
Oh, is that a bus lane?
I've got one as well.
Jesus.
For going in a bloody bus lane, I didn't even see it. £65. Jesus Christ. So it sounds like you're very tight and you keep each other in check, which is a great way to have a band.
Yeah, definitely. We are. Feel like we are a bit of an anomaly amongst a lot of other bands. We basically all live on the same road now.
Like the Beatles.
Yeah, like we all live literally that close to each other. None of us have like moved elsewhere. I'm married to Joe's sister.
Oh, really?
We are all friends and hang out, and me and Joe are actually brother-in-laws now, so it's took on a whole new meaning. But
that's amazing.
I don't know, I feel like we're all on the same page with it, and we respect each other, and it just kind of works, you know.
I love that. It sounds amazing. I mean, that's what a band is all about for me. I think that's just a lovely... That fills me full of joy. How do you write? Do you share the spoils?
Yeah, which I also think is a big part of it. Because I think if that stuff comes up early doors,
yeah,
you know, you just hear horror stories, don't you? It's splitting bands up, and I write the songs, but ultimately we're a band, and
yeah,
it wouldn't be the same without the band. So,
oh, like say Tom writes the songs. Do you know what I mean? Tom could easily not share it. Do you know what I mean? Which obviously we're very grateful for. But like Tom says, do you know what I mean? Brings it in, and then we all sort of contribute. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. Sometimes you've already got it in your head. We're like, I know how this needs to sound. Yeah. All the time. It's a bit like, oh, I've
but that's
this.
The point. You're not going to go into each song and say, No. Them conversations were just never entertained, doesn't it? It was just like, we're a band, that this is the way it's going to be. And I looked to, as a songwriter, I looked to the bands who've, whether or not they're completely true, you'll never know how a band's run until you sit them down and say, how do you split it? But on the grapevine and online, you hear bands like Arctic Monkeys, they split everything, even though Alex Turner's the primary songwriter. U2, they've stayed together.
R.E.M. were the same.
Yeah, all these bands kind of who've stuck it out seem to have, that seemed to be the blueprint. So from day dot, I was like, well, that's what I want to do.
Do you know what I was going to say? From the outside now, you can sort of see why it would get a bit, ooh.
100%.
When you start actually getting traction and stuff, because then you'd be like,
one of you just go, boof.
Yeah, like, think about publishing, think about PRS. Yeah, yeah. Like, the divide would just be unreal, really. And yeah, it just wouldn't, yeah, it would no longer be a band. You become session musicians, don't you? And then people don't want to do it as much, and people be like,
yeah,
lose a bit of integrity, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, it's just like, the divide is just not yeah, anything that entertained us, I suppose.
And where do you find the inspiration for your songs, the lyrics?
I suppose it alters as you kind of grow and experience stuff. On the whole, I try to write about, you know, myself and experiences and friends. Usually it's, you know, relationships has been a big thing, as most songwriters throughout the years have proved it works. Yeah. So, you know, like I said before, I felt like I started writing better songs when I was in my first relationship. That started off with, like, love songs. Remember there's a song called I Feel Love, which I kind of felt like, oh, this is better than all the other songs I've wrote. And the words mm-hmm. kind of matched up to it. Then we broke up. Then loads of songs came off the back of that. And that was just as we'd started. So we kind of got an influx of that.
Tom's breakup was the best thing for my career.
Yeah.
It always works, doesn't it?
And then I got in another relationship, you know, then that broke up. And that was just around the time we got a record deal. So then the first album is, you know, half of them songs are like breakup songs. And even the second record as well. So that inspired a lot of it. And then as you get older and your life becomes a bit more, not plain sailing, because, you know, there's always things, but, you know,
it's settled, isn't it?
It is a bit more settled than it was when you're in the throes of your first relationship, experiencing things for the first time. Like, you know, I'm married now, I'm in a successful band, like, I don't have that much to moan about, really, but
no,
you have to look
good
elsewhere. So there's a song, for example, called Your Girlfriend, which came from, I had the idea of, like, well, what's another take on a love song? So I thought, oh, you know, imagine someone who's in love with a friend's girlfriend. So I didn't actually feel like that, obviously. But I googled it, hit into Google, you know, a blog comes up, and I'm reading about this guy who's basically saying, you know, they live together, she comes round, they rent a place. So I just put all this in the song, and the song is about being in love with a friend's girlfriend and hearing them sleeping with each other through the bedroom walls, which I thought was quite funny.
Yeah.
So that was like, that was how I got out of my comfort zone in terms of challenging myself to just write about something completely made up, so.
So it must have been an exciting experience to record your first album. I know it was for Squeeze, but what was it like for you guys?
Well, it was great, wasn't it?
I don't know. It's.
I remember the time we went into Parr Street. That's where we recorded it, in Liverpool, with James Scully.
Oh, yeah.
But the first time we went in there, kind of, you know, it felt like a big studio, didn't it? It felt like this
was
a proper studio.
I remember going in and going into the big room, and it was like, after, like you said, the first time in like a big studio. I remember thinking, but where are we recording? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I didn't like quite believe that we were going to be in that big room. Then we were. I was like, oh my God, like, look at the size of the desk. Do you know what I mean? Things like that.
Yeah.
I think we all put like a photo on Instagram of just like the desk. Do you know what I mean? Just like.
To be fair though, we kind of got signed quite late on in our
trajectory.
Yeah, we were already selling out the Ritz in Manchester, which is like 1,500 capacity. So we kind of had a fan base before we got signed. Like, loads of labels passed on us. No one thought, you know, we were right. So we kind of had like maybe 4 or 5 singles which were going to go on the album at that point. My point was, when we got signed, we went in and finished off the album, but we kind of had half of it already done. It didn't kind of feel like, oh, we're going in and recording an album for a month and we're going to all live together. We've never really done that. We're still like, right, we'll go in, you do the album, then you go home at night. That's how we did the first album, anyway.
Yeah. It's like in blocks of three, I think, wasn't it? Like 3 days, and we'd sort of be on tour with someone, and it was like another 3 days, and it was like, oh, back to Manchester for a gig. Do you know what I mean? It was like, and also, I think even our record deal, which sounds really boring, but our record deal was like a one album deal with like, and they had like exclusivity to sign us again. So I even think because of that, we were a bit like, we knew we still had a sort of lot of work, or we knew we had to just keep and follow up with it. Do you know what I mean? I think
we worked quite quickly
helped
as well in the studio. Like, we had like a blueprint from doing the singles with James Skelly already there.
Yeah.
So we just kind of, I wrote more songs and we just did them. Like, we've done them. But I suppose, I do think, kind of, recording that first album evolved us into the band we are today, because we went in there with James Skelly with, like, Hammond organ sounds, because that's all that was lying about the Scaffolding Yard. Yeah. So all the keyboard lines that I'd write at my Casio at home, Miles would then play them on, like, this organ, and they became, like, this kind of thing. But then, once we started going into the studio with James, he was like, "You'll never get on Radio 1 with an organ." So he was like, "Fuck that off." And he just brought out all these synths. So then we obviously did, we didn't even know what synths were, really. We were like, "Oh, that's what you hear on all them great 80s records." And then that kind of, don't know, it just changed a little bit of, you know, how it kind of sounded. And then
I suppose it changed your writing a little bit as well, because you started then listening to sounds more.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And writing things from a sound rather than...
Or a keyboard sound, you know, would kind of influence it. And it got away from that kind of 60s Doors organ sound, which is how we kind of started out. But that was just the evolution.
That's an amazing sound, though. I hope you managed to bring it back.
Oh, yeah.
We love that. They still do some of them live. When we, you know, when we got like the one-off Manchester gigs and stuff, we'll bring back some of the old B-sides and the old songs. And it's weird. Mm-hmm. It goes full circle, because as we carry on now, you kind of like, oh, get the Hammond organ out and we'll put it on a track and do, you know.
I think like Tom said, I think when Jay sort of pulled them out, it was fresh and exciting. Do you know what I mean? And then obviously you do it for a bit and then you sort of go, oh, and you sort of get that out again, like Tom mentioned, then you go, oh, God. And it feels fresh and exciting again. Do you know what I mean? Comes in like waves and circles.
In every episode of I Never Thought It Would Happen, we hear from an artist who's benefited directly from Help Musicians and learn a little about their experiences and the support the charity provides.
Hi, I'm Brian Cooney. I'm based in Belfast, Northern Ireland, with a band called Junk Drawer. I'm also a music writer. I contribute to a few different publications, including Pitchfork and The Guardian and the likes. And I'm also an editor of a music magazine and website in Ireland called Thin Air. All the members of Junk Drawer, we come from rural Northern Ireland. We're from Mid-Ulster. I think we all came together out of a sense of feeling that, you know, we're slightly outsiders, and we bonded over similar types of music in certain bands. Bands like Slint and Quasi, who are a two-piece from Portland. There was also bands like Captain Beefheart and, you know, My Bloody Valentine and Dinosaur Jr. Built a Spill. Basically, a lot of guitar heroes. I think a high point for me was releasing our album, I'm Ready for the House. We were incredibly proud of it. Holding the vinyl was quite a moment. It's one of those things where it genuinely seemed like an impossible goal. My early 20s, I couldn't have imagined doing something like that. It was a genuine dream come true. Getting funding actually from Help Musicians, the Do It Differently Fund, has been incredibly useful in following that up. So we've been working on an EP, which we're releasing in March. Other highlights, I think supporting Built to Spill and bands like McCluskey, both of whom we love, winning the best single prize at the Northern Ireland Music Prize in 2019, which was sponsored by Help Musicians as well, was definitely a high point. In late 2019, I had sciatic pain and had spinal surgery out of the blue. And whilst I was recovering, I was advised to contact Help Musicians about support. I knew that it was an incredibly reputable organisation in charity. I got support from the Health and Welfare Fund for that. Just the knowledge that Help Musicians were there to support was incredibly... It was actually vital for a lot of musician friends of mine, including myself. I've long suspected that the root of inner turmoil in many people is to do with economic precarity or worries. It's something that we all have to contend with, but knowing that there was a monthly payment coming through that would cushion the blow there, it really did alleviate a lot of that sort of existential doom. The wolf was at the door, but it wasn't going to get through the door, you know, and the support there was a real barricade. Knowing that you could actually turn off your mind a little, it was very empowering. I think one thing the pandemic has taught us is that the idea of flying solo and feeling you're impervious, having pride and asking for help, or just expressing that you're feeling low or you need some sort of assistance, there's nothing wrong with that. Don't be afraid to reach out, because people are almost always there to reach out back.
You can discover how to support Help Musicians, and you can find them on all social media platforms, or you can go to their website at helpmusicians.org. And the whole lockdown thing came, did that kind of stump you? Did it sort of put a block in the way?
Not really. It did live, obviously. Like, we just released our third album, and we felt like we'd stepped up the live show, and, you know, we had like extra session musicians on stage and, you know, backing singers, and it kind of felt like we had this kind of talking heads channeling stage thing, which we were really excited about. So we did like five shows and then it got stopped and we were a bit gutted about that. But
yeah,
I've always wrote at home. I've never wrote on tour. So I kind of just settled into, got pissed for a few nights and then, as everyone probably did, and then I kind of then found myself, you know, just like I would if I was at home, writing songs again. And I just kind of ended up writing another album in the lockdown, which we then went and recorded once we could go out and work, so to speak. And so we kind of used it to be productive, and we did a lot of isolation covers. I don't know if you ever saw anything that we did like that. It was kind of, we all recorded our bits at home right at the start of lockdown, and we'd like edit it together and put it online. And I suppose we're workaholics in a way as a band. We can't just sit about. I can't personally. So I think that kind of then bleeds into everything.
Yeah, it was an amazing time in a way, because it got you to really focus on stuff that you wanted to do. Because when you're in a band and the wheels keep turning on the tour bus and stuff, you don't get a chance to stop. So in a way, COVID came along and it made us all stop.
Yeah,
it's like when bands have hiatus. I sort of get that now. When bands have that little break, I sort of understand why they might need, because after that was like, I suppose, our hiatus, you know what I mean, where it was like, oh, you can actually stop, but we can't do anything. So it was like, I think even just to reflect back on everything, I never really sat down
and actually live a little as well.
Yeah, and just
not that we could much during the pandemic, but you know, just actually enjoy your family members and, you know, whoever you had around you, and things at home that you wouldn't usually get to enjoy while you're on tour. It it was a nice period to reflect, really, wasn't it?
That's what, looking back at like what we've done, what we've achieved and stuff, that was the thing where I was like, oh my God.
I think it gave us, once the gigs came back, it gave us fresh perspective on it, and kind of, not that we were taking it for granted, but like you said, the wheels keep turning and you kind of, you normalise coming out and people are screaming and everything, whereas I feel like since then I've enjoyed the gigs so much more, because I feel like I just never take anything for granted again, because we're in such a privileged position to be able to do this for a living, and it's like,
absolutely, God, incredible.
I wouldn't change it. And you know,
have you got any festivals coming up during the summer?
Yeah, Glastonbury.
Oh, see you there. Oh, amazing.
Be good in that.
There is more, but that's the one you always remember, and it's like the best one. Truck Festival. We're doing the Thursday night headline. We're headlining Why Not. We're actually headlining a few. We're co-headlining Neighbourhood. You know, we're moving up the bill. We've still got our name in the font, which is kind of always a bit of a, you know, you're doing all right if you're in the font.
We're going on tour with the Killers. Is that May?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, May, yeah, it's not far.
Which is kind of like mini festivals at each gig, I suppose, really.
Yeah, because they're like football stadiums, aren't they?
So that'll be nice.
Oh, God, you lucky guys. What a great tour to be on.
Yeah. No, yeah, it's great.
They're an amazing band. I love them.
Yeah, we grew up listening to the Killers, and you're a massive, massive fan, aren't you, Charles?
Yeah, that was kind of like the first record I properly got into. You know, when you buy your first record from HMV or whatever, that was my first insight into what I wanted to do, you know. When the Killers first came out, I always thought they were English, because Brandon Flowers has got such an English sound, and it turns out he is an Anglophile. And I always thought they sounded a bit like Shed 7. And I've since said
Shed
that.
Shed 7?
I've since said that to him, and I think he was a little bit offended by it, to be honest.
I think I would be, in a kind of nice way. Yes, but
great band, and can't wait to go out on
the road. Gonna have to keep like buy one of them toddler harnesses for you, aren't we? That come on, Charlie, leave them to it.
One of those little bouncers in the door.
Charlie's just excited.
What day are you playing the Glastonbury show?
Friday.
On the Friday night, or
other stage? Afternoon
time, yeah, on the other stage.
Oh, okay, yeah, I'll be there. That'll be great.
Yeah.
Where are you playing, Chris? Which stage are you playing?
Well, I'm doing a stand-up solo show at the Acoustic Tent, which is the story of Glastonbury, which I've been asked to do, because I went to the very first one, although I don't remember anything about it because I was tripping out of my head. But it was many, many years ago, of course, and, you know, I was in a different space. You know, it's one of those festivals that it becomes like a huge cathedral of love and music, so it's going to be great to be there again.
Yeah.
This isn't the first time me and you have spoke, by the way, Chris. We played at Festival Number 6 about 7 years ago, maybe 2015, and I was at the back of the bus, you at the front of the bus. It was just me and you on the bus. It was so weird. And I was like, that's Chris Stifford from Squeeze, and we got off the bus and you were really nice with me, so thanks very much for that.
Where was that?
Festival Number 6, Port Merion.
Oh, they'd like the transport.
Oh my God, yeah, I do remember that gig. Yeah. That was weird. What a weird gig.
Yeah,
it's a strange festival. I love it. It's strange in a great way, but it's I mean, Port Merion itself is just mad, isn't it? It's like, it's off its
head.
Like
a toy town, isn't it?
Yeah, you just sort of walk him around like, this place is mental. But
yeah.
It's great. Great festival.
The guy that looks after it he invited me to come and stay, but I was too freaked out by it all. I can't come and stay there. It's weird. America, is that in your sights at all?
It's always in our sights. I mean, I suppose we never got like a record deal there. You know, when you first come out, you obviously get a UK record deal and that distributes you or whatever elsewhere. But we never got another one in the US. So I feel like we've never had a proper push there.
No.
We've had little bits of like, oh, these people work there and these will help you push it. But we've never had, you know, a proper team behind it going, bang, right, I'll get you on this radio show. So we've kind of not really made much waves over there, have we? We've done bits and bobs. We do all right in LA and New York, and we're going back there this year, and we're always open to giving it a go, but it's dead expensive to take a band round there and kind of go around all the radio shows. It's kind of we'd need like some serious backing to do it properly.
I was gonna say, that's like the negative side of it all, isn't it? It's like just the cost involved with all of it, outrageous. And it's dead boring. Like, how boring is that to say? Like, you know what I mean? Like, our creativity is being stopped by the boring financial side of it.
No, it's really important, all of that stuff, of course. And lots of people invest in going to South by Southwest, like you have, I think. And, and that's kind of lots of pissed people walking in and out of clubs and not really taking it on board.
Yeah. I was going to say, but like, strange thing with South by, it's like, I suppose that's like, I think that's why it's great for a sort of a band starting out to get in there, because it's like all them industry from all over America actually are in one place, where usually it's like, oh no, that's that state and then this state. If you're going to do that, well, you have to do this. You know what I mean? It's all like so, it's huge, isn't it, America? So it's sort of, it feels really disconnected. Whereas like over here, it's like, right, you can go down, go to London, do a radio show, the whole country, bam. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's sort of just like, I don't know, it seems more achievable, whereas America just seems like this massive void of sort of like putting
states,
pieces of puzzles together. Do you know what I mean? Sort of try and build it up. But obviously, including that is ridiculous visa fees and things like that.
I think a big support tour would be quite...
I think that's what your manager's got to find, or your agent's got to find.
We'll get into Brandon Flowers on this one and say next time, because he's already taken
next time
people out. It's like, right, next time we'll you know, we'll jump on with you, mate.
We'll do you a favour, Brandon.
No, it's quite contradictory, actually, because I was listening to the podcast you did with Sting, and you got onto talking about breaking America and this, that and the other, and he said the opposite. He didn't want to support like big bands like Foreigner. They just wanted to do like the little club shows and go from state to state and do that kind of thing, which is, you know, it's mad how times change, isn't it, in that respect?
Yeah, well, we did that as well. We did that before the Police, and we were there for 3 months playing every shithole you can imagine. But it was kind of interesting, because now when we go back, some of those people that were there are still coming to see us. Wow. So it's about putting in the footwork.
Do you do well in the States, like...
We do now, yeah, of course. We did an 11-week tour last year, and that was great. But it's, you know, you have to put in the legwork. Like, as you say, it's a jigsaw. It's got so many states to it, and everyone is so different. You know, some people in the Midwest are not as tuned in as on the East Coast or the West Coast. Yeah. It's kind of
like
a journey.
You've got to go and live there and soak it up a little bit, haven't you? You've got to kind of, you actually really do have to dedicate a couple of months of the year to go in there, I think.
Yeah. So do you record now without a producer? Do you just knock about your own songs?
No, we still use James Skelly from The Coral.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, so he's been with us from the start, really. So he did the first record, and we've ended up, you know, a bit of a George Martin and the Beatles kind of set up. We've toyed with going somewhere else. We nearly went to Nashville on the third record, but then we just didn't end up doing it for whatever reason, and ended up staying with James in Liverpool, and it just works, and we've kind of grown together, and he doesn't want us to stay in one lane, and we don't. And as a songwriter, for me personally, because obviously none of the lads are songwriters in the band, I don't necessarily have another songwriter to bounce stuff off with. Not co-writing, but, you know, like just ideas, and like, you know, oh, listen to this song, you know listen to the lyrics in this song, that kind of thing, like you would. But me and James kind of have that relationship, so he's kind of a bit like a Jedi master, and he's involved a lot. He doesn't just hear the songs and then produce them. He's there for the whole journey with us, in a way. So it's kind
of... That's amazing, yeah.
Obviously, I think going forward, and he would probably want us one day to do it with someone else, or, you know, it'd be interesting to see what would happen, but it's a great relationship that's not really got any negatives. So
I say, we've always said, because I can mention before, one day we want to try and build a studio here. But you've always said, haven't you, like, oh, well, if we ever did sort of self-record, we'd always want a producer to come in as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think them like sort of fresh ears that come in and they can just hear little things. Do you know what I mean? That,
yeah, it's really important. I agree, yeah.
It's like another perspective, isn't it, from it? Sort of going, oh, yeah, I can see why you did that, but you've done that loads. You know what I mean? Like, you're just sort of pushing you out of that comfort zone, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, well, if you found someone you can trust, that's gold dust, you know. Yeah, they're very difficult to find.
And he's brutally honest as well, which I think helps. Oh, yeah. Like, you know, for the last album, this new album, we demoed maybe like 20 songs. And to whittle them down to get like 10 out of it, you know, the feedback that he gave us was like, he's laughable. And, you know, if you weren't thick-skinned and knew him enough, you'd be like offended. But, you know, you need that to get to where you want to get in terms of whittling songs down. And like you said, that fresh perspective on him.
He just literally sent back the song titles, didn't he? The demos are saying, like,
nah.
Nah. This one sounds like summer.
Yeah.
I know collectively, being in a band, you can have some very dark moments, and I just wondered if you'd had any of those that you'd like to share.
We did a gig at the Macbeth in London before we were signed, and it was, like, bigged up as, like, this is, like, a showcase gig for you. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is going to be, like, all the record labels are coming. This will be great. This will be the time. Do you know what I mean? Like, things are starting to move, especially in Manchester. And it was like, right, so we did this gig, sold it out, great. And then we went on, I think we played Mint, had a great gig. And then literally afterwards, all the record labels came back and were like, nope. And we, do you know what I mean? There was a bit of thing where we're like, oh, are we sort of mad for believing in this? Do you know what I mean? Like, that was the first time where I'd sort of been like, all right.
Well, up until then, we kind of just been on an upwards trajectory. Yeah. Like, we started the band and we got a great manager in Comrade and Dave, who kind of worked with the Stone Roses and Cortina, so we had a bit of weight behind us there. Then we got a booking agent and they were getting us good support slots, so we thought, like, right, we've got the foundations here, we just need a deal. And then the deal just didn't come for like a year.
Yeah. But I think having Comrade and Dave, that's probably been the biggest thing in our band, like, as in, like, a positive that stayed throughout even to this day. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
they're the people, obviously, we trust the most, which obviously you want to be because they're our manager. Do you know what I mean?
You know, things do come to you when they're supposed to.
Yeah. And to be fair, that's definitely right, because when these people were coming to watch us, we still had the Hammond organs. We still had, like, we were all wearing turtlenecks. Yeah. Like, we were a little bit old school, like, which was cool for us at the time. But I could see why people would think, well, this ain't going to, it's not modern enough, or it's not going to transcend. But we hadn't, the songs got better, you know, that extra year. I wrote some of the biggest songs we've got.
Yeah.
So that extra year, and if we'd have got a deal, I might never have wrote them. So I'm glad we didn't get signed until later on.
Yeah. Have you ever co-written outside of the band?
I've started to do a little bit more now for, like, other artists. And
And
I do enjoy it, to be fair, because there's so many songs I've wrote which I've never seen the light of day, just for whatever reason. If not, it's not right for the band or whatever. But, you know, my ultimate passion is songwriting, and that's probably what makes me the happiest. So I'm always up for doing it, really, and I'm kind of up for doing it more. So
you guys are all welcome to come to, we have this songwriting camp, it's financed by the Buddy Holly Foundation, and writers come from Nashville, Austin, LA, New York, and we just hang out in a great big house at Glastonbury, funnily enough.
Oh, nice.
It's just like a 15-minute walk from the pyramid stage. And we just have all sorts of people come. It's great fun.
No, sounds great. I'm up for that.
When do you come off stage and go, you know what, that was amazing? What was the best gig that you could put your finger on?
We always say this, like, my favourites are, me personally, it's never the, you know, the huge hometown sellout 15,000-20,000 tickets. It's never that for me, because there's always too much, like, with guest list and family. The ones I enjoy are, like, Hull Arena on a Monday night. Like, and I come off and I was like, that was the best gig we've ever done. So it's just... I don't know, it's just a split second thing when you come off, innit? Or for me personally, you sang well, you were just in the moment, you weren't thinking about anything else. They're the ones I enjoy the most, personally.
I agree with what, because them big ones are sort of midnight, but you've lived up to that moment for ages.
And you've bigged it up in your head and you're thinking about it more, whereas it's always when it catches you by surprise that you enjoy it more.
I would say that when we did the arena in Manchester, that was like, I don't know.
That must have been great.
Do you know what I mean? There've been so many gigs there. Yeah, there have been so many gigs, and, like, all your family being there. And it was like, well, first of all, I was amazed there was people in there and it was full. Do you know what I mean? Because, like, you always have that thing in the back of your head. It's like, it's going to be half full. Do you know what I mean? Like, so, like, when I was like, oh my God, it's dead busy. And then I felt proud.
Good for
you.
Do you
know what I mean? Like, I was actually like, oh, yeah, we've wanted to do this for so long. And, like, all them gigs and all that time, like, this is what we've wanted to do. So, like, I was proper buzzing with that. But I did, I asked my girlfriend to marry me after that gig. She said yeah, so she's now my fiancée.
Oh my God.
I don't know why the fuck I did that, because I was absolutely shitting it the whole gig for that as well. You know, it's like double pressure. I was like, why have I done this to myself? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, I should have picked another day.
But a lot of stress in one night. Amazing.
No, yeah. It did mean I didn't drink that much through the gig, though, so that was
that's amazing. So as a band, which I love being in a band, I love the gang of being in a band. Yeah. Do you ever sort of see into the future, or do you just take it one week at a time sort of thing?
It's weird, like, well, you know what it's like. Sometimes it's hard not to see Dead Fire in the future, because sort of it's like, oh, well, next year we've got this planned and this tour planned. Do you know what I mean? So you can't sort of help. And if you sort of go on your diary on your phone now, you know what I mean? You just sort of scroll up. There'll be something in the calendar there that's like, oh, potential dates for this, this. Do you know what I mean? So it's it's sort of quite hard to, but...
We always look to the future in like a longevity perspective. And I think if you focus too hard on the future, things can become a little bit contrived. So... I think collectively we all kind of take each day as it comes and just try and work as hard as possible in the moment.
That's good, that's good. And what about, you should have that dream of playing Madison Square Garden, I think, always.
Oh, yeah. Who doesn't?
Always.
Carnegie Hall.
Yeah. Why not?
We're doing that in the summer, aren't we?
I said why not, and we're playing Why Not Festival. Oh, right. Charlie made a dad joke.
That's amazing. And my stepdaughter told me that you have your own podcast.
We do, yeah.
It's called The Blossoms Pubcast, and it's very lighthearted, and we just kind of, it's just basically us chatting like we
in the pub.
In a pub.
On tour or in the pub, and yeah, it's just a laugh, really, and we have little sections to it, and we'll have, like, the negative YouTube comment of the week where we go and find people who've slagged us off on YouTube and read out the worst one, and sometimes we'll go into, like, the demoing process and, you know, how I wrote the song and break down the songs and stuff, and... But then, literally, it'll be like...
I'll just tell a lie and you've got to guess if it's a lie or real.
Yeah, then we'll call, like, my granddad John, who's, like, a bit of a character, and he'll have a story for us and an anecdote, and then we've got a section called It's Not Hard, Is It, Haven't We?
Yeah.
Which is, basically, if something good has happened to us throughout the week, we'll just say, It's Not Hard, Is It? And then tell the story.
It's something we used to say to
it's so daft.
Yeah. Like, we'd say it to each other and be like... You know, say you found £2 outside, you'd be like, I found £2 on the way out, it's not hard, is it? Like,
yeah. But we made a jingle for it and everything. It's like,
it's a good tune, the jingle.
You have to come on it
I'd love to be on it. It'd be
amazing. At some point, we have a section where we get guests. That was a new thing we did last time where we get guests on and they pick the top 5 songs from Manchester. So
that'd be amazing.
We'll get you on to do that. And
I'd love to
do
that.
Then we can talk about the songs.
That'd be great.
It isn't hard anyway, so I can definitely do that.
Yeah.
I want to thank you guys for spending this time with us. And it's really great for the charity to have people like yourselves talking about your lives, and it will inspire other people to keep on going. So
totally.
Thank you very much, and thank your engineer who's in the corner there.
Do you know what that's? Our engineer is Miles. He's
the keyboard player.
Oh, Miles, I'm so sorry. How are you?
I'm all right, I'm just here.
Just here.
I know, Josh is outside.
Josh made the teas.
What a band, what a band. I want to be in your band. I will make the tea. Josh can fuck off and I'll make the tea.
This is why I share the songwriting.
Alright, thanks a lot you guys, thank you.
Thank you very much, cheers.
Cheers mates.
Cheers mate.
Have a great day.
See you soon. It's always such a pleasure talking to young bands who are on their way up and so obviously excited about and in love with what they do. In fact, I find it incredibly inspiring. And the fact that they sound like a true bunch of lads just having a great time gives me hope for the future. But unlike Blossoms, my drummer is never keen to bring out the biscuits or a cup of tea. To find out more about the wonderful work Help Musicians do, have a look at their website for loads more information. And please subscribe to this podcast. Thank you once again for listening. Please keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.